The Guardian. Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Friday, February the 15th. Today, the UK is a soft touch to its enemies, says a leading defence think tank, because of a misguided approach to multiculturalism.
The United Kingdom is indeed a target, and what makes it a target, which isn't, in our view, well enough understood, is the divided nature of our society.
Vladimir Putin lambasts the West as hypocrites for backing Kosovo's bid for independence from Serbia. And two High Court judges consider quashing a decision by the Serious Fraud Office to abandon its investigation into alleged corruption in a £43 billion deal between Britain's biggest arms company and Saudi Arabia.
The judge said it was remarkable the way the government had just rolled over to this alleged Saudi blackmail, and they hadn't sought to say, look, in our country we don't do things like that. In our country the law is independent.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis from guardian.co.uk.
But before we hear about any of that, let's have today's news headlines from Sandy Waugh.
Britain has become a soft touch for homegrown terrorists. A report today says British values and national identity have been weakened, and that's made the country more vulnerable to attack. The Royal United Services Institute criticises the government for its misplaced policies on multiculturalism. These have led to a fragmented society, they say. The government thought British lives were at risk if an arms deal inquiry had gone ahead. Court documents say that Saudi Arabia threatened to facilitate attacks on London unless the proceedings were halted. The claims were made as two pressure groups sought to overturn the decision to halt the investigation by the Serious Fraud Office. And we'll have more on those stories in just a moment. The US President George W. Bush has defended his policy of not sending troops to the Sudanese region of Darfur. Whilst describing the situation there as a genocide, he called it a seminal decision not to intervene with force. Also in the BBC interview, the President cited the London July the 7th bombings to justify his support for waterboarding. The interrogation technique is widely regarded as torture, but he said it helped obtain information that saved lives. Also in the US, John McCain has received the unexpected endorsement of his rival Mitt Romney. Having dropped out of the race to secure the Republican nomination for president, Romney has put aside his political and personal differences to back McCain. Football and three British teams were in action in the first legs of their UEFA Cup games last night. Tottenham overcame Slavia Prague 2-1 in the Czech Republic. Bolton defeated Atletico Madrid at home 1-0. And Aberdeen drew with Bayern Munich 2-2 at Pittodrie. Now for today's papers, The Telegraph and The Mail both lead on the warnings that Britain is a soft touch for terrorists. The Independent pursues its campaign to shame China into helping Darfur, but talks of the Great Wall of Indifference. The Sun has a picture of boxer Ricky Hatton draped in the Union Jack. He explains his manifesto to repair broken Britain. And The Mirror reveals that FIFA will block England's bid to host the World Cup unless the Premier League scraps its plans to play some games abroad. There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
Us Britons are confused about our national identity and our country's place in the world. We're facing a crisis of confidence that's making us vulnerable to attack. That's according to a group of senior British military figures in a report published today by the Royal United Services Institute, an influential defence think tank. One of its co-authors is Professor Gwyn Prins of the London School of Economics.
The seminar, which has been meeting for 18 months, from which this article in the RUSI journal comes, takes the considered view across the expertise of all those participating, and they include, as you may want to know, senior military people, diplomats, academics, politicians, businessmen and others, take the view that the United Kingdom is indeed a target, and what makes it a target, which isn't, in our view, well enough understood, is the divided nature of our society. And why that matters for many of the risks that we face in the security and defense field is that if we haven't got a settled view in our own minds about who we are or who our enemies are or how to deal with them, then if you're dealing with an enemy that is implacable and has a very clear sense of who it is, and Islamist terrorists come immediately to mind in that regard, then you play to their strengths and you make us weak.
You say that one of the things that making the situation worse is the fact that the majority has a misplaced deference to multiculturalism and a failure to lay down the line to immigrant communities. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Well, I think this is now a very generally understood sentiment. It became quite clear after the bombings in the London Underground that the approach of multiculturalism interpreted in the slack way that says that somehow you are showing respect to people by letting them do their own thing, have their own sets of values, even if they run contrary to the main values of the society, that this is actually counterproductive, because in this country, as has happened in the Netherlands, for example, which followed a similar policy until it also changed, what this does is actually create more a ghetto environment for those who are encapsulated within fundamentalist beliefs. And so that lesson, I think, was well learned. People like Trevor Phillips from the Commission on Racial Equality have understood that.
Your report calls for the creation of a new cabinet committee that would coordinate security policy. How would that work?
Well, it actually calls for two committees, and these are very carefully thought through and powerful constitutional innovations in the British system. What the cabinet committee will do is to create a circumstance in which all the many different organs of government which have an interest in security and which are at the moment fragmented can be brought together, and it will be an analysing and a judging committee. That's why it won't be chaired by the Prime Minister. It'll be chaired by a senior cabinet minister, not him, in order to make the executive decisions that are made under the Prime Minister's chairmanship more coherent, more balanced, more closely connected to a joined-up government policy on security and defence. We think that it's vital that Parliament be brought back in a powerful way, and that's why the second of the twin committees is a committee of both houses, of which all members will become Privy Councillors if they are not already, which means they will take the oath of secrecy to the monarch, and where the chairmanship will be by a senior member of the opposition.
That's Professor Gwyn Prins, and there's more on the Royal United Services Institute's report at guardian.co.uk/defence. Also on The Guardian's website today, Alok Jha reports from the American Association for the Advancement of Science conference in Boston. Read the latest at guardian.co.uk/science. George Bush heads for Africa tomorrow. Our Africa editor Chris McGreal reports on the kind of reception he's likely to get. guardian.co.uk/America. And how the case that there was a conspiracy to kill Diana, Princess of Wales, is falling apart at the inquest into her death. More at guardian.co.uk/monarchy. In December 2006, the government halted a serious fraud office inquiry into alleged corruption in a 1985 arms deal worth £43 billion between BAE, Britain's biggest arms company, and Saudi Arabia. Now, two pressure groups are asking High Court judges to quash the decision by the director of the serious fraud office to drop its investigation. The Guardian's David Lee has the story.
What's emerged from this court case as it goes along is a flood of documents that show a very extraordinary pattern of events, because they show that the real driver of all the campaign to get the investigation dropped has been, lo and behold, the very company who were a criminal suspect in the case, BAE. It was they who tried to go behind the back of the SFO 2 years ago to try and persuade government ministers to get the case dropped. And it's been them who've been rumbling along in the background all the time saying, oh, terrible things will happen if we're prosecuted. And of course, the SFO has always been very reluctant to listen to them, because if criminal suspects go around saying, get the police off our back, well, they've got their personal interest in that, haven't they?
What is it alleged in the High Court was the role of Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia in persuading Tony Blair to intervene?
The picture that's been painted by the campaigners in the High Court is that Prince Bandar, who is a very powerful Saudi diplomat, and he's the son of the Saudi defense minister, all this family run Saudi Arabia is a bit of a family business, that he was behind the threats, the blackmail, as they call it, and that in effect Prince Bandar was saying, we're going to allow bombs to go off in the streets of London because we're not going to do anything about giving you intelligence about terrorists if my name comes out in this bribery allegation.
So the SFO director is accused in court of allowing threats or blackmail to influence his decision.
The judge said it was remarkable the way the government had just rolled over to this alleged Saudi blackmail, and they hadn't sought to say, look, in our country, we don't do things like that. In our country, the law is independent, you know, and politicians cannot interfere with the rule of law. And instead, he pointed out that Tony Blair appeared to have just rolled over to this alleged blackmail.
Now, David, this hearing's continuing today in the High Court. What will happen if there's a defeat for the SFO and the government?
Well, the most interesting thing that's going on about this ongoing case, to tell you the truth, is the disclosure of all these normally secret documents about what really went on backstairs, you know, and it's a pretty startling and sordid story. The eventual judgment is a bit of a secondary issue. If the court rules that they're going to overturn the head of the SFO's decision, then they will send him away to reconsider it. But of course, the SFO and the government might appeal. And if the SFO director is made to reconsider, well, he might just take the same decision all over again.
David Lee, and there's full coverage of proceedings today in the High Court at guardian.co.uk/BAE. And that's the place you can also look at those documents David mentions that have been revealed in court. My name's John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, government claims that Britain is leading the way in the switch to renewable energy are exposed as a sham by new statistics, and the dangers facing photographers as they attempt to document the struggle against violent drug traffickers in Rio de Janeiro.
It's an urban guerrilla war. You know that apparently everything is fine one moment and suddenly there's a shootout, people running everywhere. You never know when something might happen.
But first, in a few days' time, the province of Kosovo is expected to declare its independence from Serbia. Belgrade said yesterday that it wouldn't allow itself to be humiliated by what it says would amount to a puppet state on its territory. Serbia's main ally is Russia. And yesterday, in his annual press conference, which lasted almost 5 hours, the Russian President Vladimir Putin says it would be immoral and illegal to recognise a declaration of independence. Luke Harding's our Moscow correspondent.
Putin made it very clear that Russia would respond very angrily indeed. He basically said that the idea of Kosovan independence was illegal, ill-conceived, and immoral. I mean, he didn't mince his words. He then went on to say that Russia would be forced to act, although he didn't spell out what precisely Moscow would do if Kosovo does declare independence unilaterally. And he basically launched into a tirade against the West, accusing Europe and America of double standards. He sort of said, well, you know, Great Britain fought to preserve its territorial integrity in Northern Ireland for 400 years. So why is the West so kind of jolly keen to grant the Kosovans independence? He basically said he regarded it as another separatist republic and a very ominous sort of precedent for all those other sort of separatist enclaves across the world.
Did he go as far as to say that Moscow would be prepared to recognise the independence of pro-Russian separatist regions in what was the Soviet Union?
Well, he did mention these regions, but he didn't actually make clear what Moscow's strategy would be. You're completely right. There's speculation that Russia could recognise Ossetia and Abkhazia, which are breakaway regions of Georgia, and Transnistria, which is another enclave, which is technically Moldova, but which is also broken away. Whether Russia will go that far yet, we don't know. But it's clear that he feels that Russia's objections on this point have been marginalised. And he sort of feels the international community is sort of having its cake and eating it. You know, when they want independence, they get it. And when they don't, they don't.
These comments from Putin were made at his annual news conference yesterday. A bit of a marathon, Luke.
I have to say, you know, I've sort of reported from all over the world. This was the longest press conference I've ever been to. 4 hours and 45 minutes. I was sitting in the front row about 8 feet away from the great man. There was no possibility of escape or tunnelling under the carpet. I was stuck there. And it did become increasingly surreal. Some of it was very interesting. At points, Mr. Putin took a very elegiac tone. He talked about the heavy burden of being president of Russia. He said that he felt sorry for George Bush, who was in a similar position, which was quite interesting. He said nothing about Britain, which is not a country he likes, but he was asked, someone asked, one of the female reporters, rather attractive female reporter, asked him if he'd go for a date, because Valentine's Day is pending. He talked about gardening, childbirth, housing. I mean, it was an extraordinary and at times sort of surreal.
He was also asked about his personal wealth.
This is actually a story I wrote in December for The Guardian, where citing an analyst who was in turn citing sources inside the presidential administration, we ran a story saying that the president was basically the beneficial owner of three Russian oil and gas companies, or at least parts of them, and that his fortune was $40 billion. What was very interesting was that he gave a rather sort of stage-managed reply to the question, you know, are you the richest man in Europe? He said, first of all, he said, I am, with a kind of smile. And then he said, you know, the only richness I have is the richness of my people's love. And then finally he said, this is, I think the word he used was horseshit.
The Guardian.
On today's Football Weekly Extra, Ronaldo, as Orphenomenal and his militant tendons part company once again, is this the last we see of a footballing legend? Elsewhere, there's Ireland going Trappist, desk-banging, grammar-chewing Giovanni Trapattoni turning green and preparing to face his own country in the World Cup qualifiers. We look at the Copa Libertadores, South America's Champions League, with Fernando Duarte and Marcelo Moreno Araujo. We hear about Spain from Sid Lowe in Madrid. And it's fun, unpretentious, and its idea of a glamorous foreign venue is Cardiff. We salute the joys of the Championship. That's all on Football Weekly Extra. For more details, go to guardian.co.uk/football.
Energy Minister Malcolm Wicks says Britain is showing leadership in switching to renewable sources of energy. But our economics correspondent Ashley Seeger says new figures show the scale of the challenge facing Britain.
It's quite shocking, John. I have looked at some Energy Savings Trust figures that showed that 270 grants were given for household photovoltaic systems in the whole of Britain last year, 270. In Germany, they installed 130,000 systems in over the same time period.
If you live in the UK at the moment and you want to install a solar panel on your home, what kind of help could you expect to get at the moment from the government?
Precious little. It would be very difficult for the hot water ones. You can get a flat £400 grant for a system that'll cost you probably £3,000. So it's 10 or 12%. Government considers this a mature technology that doesn't need much support, and they may have a point there. The more difficult one, though, is solar photovoltaic cells, which make electricity, which are more expensive as a system, and for which you can get a maximum grant of £2,500. The problem is, under the current system, that it's these grants, you have to jump through all sorts of hoops and conditions now to be able to get them, as a result of which the number of people applying for grants has collapsed.
The Guardian's seen a leaked document that shows that the government's not even spending the money that it's got available to spend on renewables.
Yeah, well, this is the problem. They allocated for a three-year programme between March 2006, March 2009, they allocated originally £12 million, then topped it up to £18 million because it was being used up so quickly. It was very, very popular for obvious reasons. I myself benefited from that system in the early days. But then what they did last May was to slash the amounts available and make it more, as I mentioned, more difficult to apply for them. And so it's just become very, very difficult to get your hand in that pot. And it looks like of that 18 million funding, they themselves have admitted, BER, Department for Business, that they're going to have a 10 million underspend at the end of the period. This is at a time when Britain claims to be leading the world on climate change and claims to be showing leadership, as the Minister Malcolm Wicks said last week, in renewables. But the figures just don't add up.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Severino Silva is one of Brazil's top crime photographers with nearly 30 years reporting experience in Rio. His work for the Rio newspaper O Dia places him on the front line of the city's violent drug conflict on an almost daily basis. 2007 was one of the bloodiest years on record in Rio, and with clashes between police and drug traffickers intensifying, journalists such as Severino face unprecedented risks. The Guardian's Tom Phillips accompanied Severino to the scene of a shooting to find out what his life was like.
There was one point when we were lying down on our bellies with bullets hitting the walls above us, smashing all the pipes, water falling on top of us. There were so many shots that you just heard the noise. Right there inside the shantytown, shots come at you from both sides. Wherever you looked, you saw bullet holes. It was like a war zone. There's a sign up in our newsroom. The use of a bulletproof vest is compulsory.
I've just arrived at the Pedreira shantytown with Severino. He says there's been a shootout and at least two policemen have been injured. Apparently, there are also four dead bodies somewhere up this hill.
There's a war going on between traffickers, the Red Command and the Third Command, for the control of the shantytown. The police came in to try and stop the shooting and two police have been shot.
I just stayed inside my house. How could I leave? I wasn't even going to try. I tried to go out to work, but unfortunately when I was leaving, all the shooting started. Severino's line of work is obviously not for the light-hearted. I asked him if he felt like a war correspondent when he was out on the beat.
War correspondents are something I've only seen in films. I don't know if that's our reality here. But it's a conflict, it's an urban guerrilla war. You know that apparently everything is fine one moment and suddenly there's a shootout, people running everywhere. You never know when something might happen.
We're now following Severino up the steep hillside and into the shantytown. He's decided to train a special forces unit that's making an incursion into the area. Directly above us now there's a police helicopter with two snipers leaning out from each side. At the top of the shantytown, we find a group of 20 or so, nervous and heavily armed policemen. They're not pleased to see the press. The local commander claims it is too dangerous for any journalists to be in the area, and we are ordered into a bulletproof police tank and removed from the community.
Guys, I want to explain something to you. The police is in no way against the work of the press. It's the opposite. You're our big allies, divulging the good, even the bad things we do. But at the moment, it's not appropriate for you to be here. There are shootouts going on all the time. If one of you gets hurt, all of our work will be lost.
You see children completely terrified by the violence. You see people who are trying to get home but can't because of the shootouts. You see victims of stray bullets. If you don't have self-control, you go mad. You can't go home carrying all this emotional baggage with you because you end up passing this on to your family. At home, I often don't even say where I've been working. If they ask, I say it was all calm, fine, no problem. Sometimes they see the shootout on the TV and see us in the middle of it. There's so much bad stuff happening that your family has enough to worry about without you being in the middle of that conflict.
Guardian Daily's producers today were Phil Maynard and Ian Chambers. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.